And tonight we're going to deal with death. Terry Daniel, our special guest, whatever works, a swan in heaven. How about embracing death as well, or turning the corner on Grief Street? We'll be back with Terry in a moment. After Death Communications, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm looking forward to Terry Daniel here on Coast to Coast. Terry is a certified thanatologist. Now, that is someone who studies death. A clinical chaplain, death awareness educator, who has assisted dying and grieving individuals to discover a more spiritual understanding of death and beyond death, of course. And her very unique perspective on birth, death, and the journey of the soul helps the dying, and I got to tell you, the living, heal through this entire procedure. Here's Terry on Coast to Coast. Terry, welcome to us. Good to have you with us.
Hello, George. Thank you so much. We're very happy to be here.
How did you become a thanatologist?
Well, technically, I became a thanatologist because I was certified by the Association of Death Education and Counseling, which is how you technically become a thanatologist. But I've always been interested in metaphysical topics. I was an intuitive kid. I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead when I was a teenager, you know, Ruth Montgomery, all of these things, and this was just natural to me. My mother and my grandmother, I found out later in life, were both psychic, so being aware of other dimensions was completely comfortable and organic to my nature.
That's rare for kids at your age to be interested in that. It's interesting because when I was about 18 or 19, I read the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and then, of course, the Tibetan Book of the Dead as well, as they try to teach people what to expect on the other side. Why were we interested in that stuff, Terry?
I don't know. I guess because we, you know, some of us come into incarnation with the conduit still open. It doesn't close down as tightly for some of us as it does for others. And I think that some aspect of ourselves remembers where we were before we were here. And we have a longing to go back there. I think all of us have a longing to go back there. But some of that of us just kind of bring it into the forefront of our daily lives, I imagine. You know, it's just our calling. It's what we're here to do.
As a death awareness educator, do you deal with people who are dying with from all ages? I mean, elderly people, but younger people too?
Absolutely, yes. Dying and grieving. I've been in hospice work for about 9 years. And with grief counseling, I most often work with parents who've had a child die because really pushed me into this was that my son died when he was 16, which was about 10 years ago, and began talking to me from the other side 30 minutes after he died. and that was my first book, A Swan in Heaven, was about that. And so when I started out doing this, I just assumed that my audience would be grieving parents. And it has worked out that way, but I've now expanded into, you know, hospice work and death education for everybody. It's interesting because a lot of the material you read in the mainstream relates death awareness only to older people.
That's right.
Which is yet another way of, you know, shielding ourselves from the real reality of death, is that it happens to everybody.
How did your son start communicating with you 30 minutes after he passed?
Well, he had a rare metabolic disorder, and he was severely disabled for half his life. And during the last 3 years of his life, he lost the ability to speak. At that time, I was all just kind of miraculously developing my intuitive abilities, and I was reading tarot cards at a metaphysical bookstore.
Really? Okay.
And that was, you know, something that I was doing then, and one of the channelers came over to me and said, "Do you know that you're channeling while you're reading?" And I said, no, I'm not a channeler. You know, I just kind of read these cards from a Jungian analysis perspective of interpreting the images. And she said, no, you're channeling. And she took me under her wing and sort of coached me. And I started doing some very deep meditations, and everything just opened up for me. And I kind of received the message that the purpose in that was that I would be talking to my son after he died, because I knew that he was dying, and I knew that day was coming. And because he had lost the ability to speak, we started to communicate telepathically while he was still alive, which is not unusual, because mothers do this with nonverbal babies, pre-verbal babies, all the time,
sure.
Right?
That's true. Now, what were some of the things initially that he was saying to you?
Well, essentially, the biggest, strongest message he gave me is, okay, here I am on the other side. Let's get this party started. We have work to do. This is what we came here to do. I want you to start writing down everything that you're experiencing, everything that you're hearing from me, because we've got a book to write. It's done. I'm finally here. This was our plan. High five. Let's get going.
Does he still communicate with you, Terry?
Not in the same way. It's been close to 10 years, and for the first 3 or 4 years, he was with me constantly. I could not go through an hour with having to stop and write down some message that he was giving me. I would feel him standing behind me. I always felt him kind of at my back, kind of hugging me from behind, like spooning. And I could feel his energy, and he would teach me things like that feeling that you have where I'm at your back and we're breathing together. It's like your breath is going from your lungs to my lungs and back through you and out again. This is a technique that you're going to learn how to do in healing people and working with dying people and working with grieving people. And so that was how close he was and how very directly he taught me about the work that I'm doing now. Now, years later, it's changed, but he's like, I call him the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. Because I feel like he's directing me. I have since gone to school and gotten degrees in theology and pastoral care and became a chaplain and started the Afterlife Conference and did all this stuff. And I know that he's directing me into all this work.
That's amazing. Now, I'm a believer in reincarnation. Are you?
Absolutely.
Might he have reincarnated? This is what I'm beginning to learn. I always thought that once a soul reincarnates, that's it. They're gone. Now I'm beginning to believe that it kind of breaks off into different segments. And though it may reincarnate as the soul, there are still other aspects of that entity, that person, my father, your son, my sister, who remains. Is that the case?
I'm beginning to believe that too. And people have been asking me this question all the time. If, you know, how would you know if your son was incarnated somewhere on Earth? And I asked him this question, and he gave me the most wonderful answer. He said, if one person is fully on the other side, they can communicate easily because they're not having to go through the barrier of ego and physicality and attachment and all the stuff that we have on Earth. So if one person's on the other side, their communication flows pretty freely. If both people are on this side, then both parties have those barriers. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so the communication flows a lot less freely between the two of them because they're both now stuck in that, you know, inside the veil, inside the ego and the attachments and all this stuff. So it is much harder to communicate with someone that way if they're on Earth. However, yes, they can still communicate with us because we can all communicate telepathically, soul to soul. That's where it really happens. So in that, on that level, the body doesn't really matter. And your question is really interesting because I really felt a shift in my communication with him at about year three. And I often wondered if it meant that he's incarnated. But I just sense that he's not because I hear from him all the time. My friends who are mediums hear from him all the time. The mediums that I work with at the Afterlife Conference, who are good friends of mine now, call me on the phone and say, hey, your son came to me last night and he told me this and he told me that. And it feels real because it's always guidance that fits with what I'm doing.
Unless they have that ability to basically split off into various segments.
Well, you know, in shamanism, that is the belief that the soul is segmented that way. And certainly we know that we can be in more than one place at one time, since there is no time and that we can exist in multiple dimensions simultaneously. So, yes, absolutely.
I'd
love to know exactly, pinpoint exactly where he is.
Wouldn't that be something?
It doesn't matter because he's here.
He's there.
Everywhere.
Here, everywhere. Yeah. That's right. Why nowadays, Terry, are people becoming more and more fascinated with the other side?
I don't think that people are more fascinated with the other side. Historically, we used to be much more comfortable with death than we are now. There's this wonderful book you may know of called Western Attitudes Toward Death.
Yeah.
From, you know that book,
yeah,
Philippe?
I haven't read it. I've heard of it.
It's wonderful. You would love it. And he looks back, I think he starts in about the 13th century, and he finds that people accepted death so well. It would be like you'd be there, you'd get sick, you'd say to your family, you know what, my time has come. And you'd go to your bed, you'd call the priest, you'd call your family, and you would prepare to die. And people were not freaked out by death. It was everywhere. There was death in the streets, the animals on the farm died, the babies died, everybody was dying. We didn't get afraid of death until probably around the 17th century, and there's a lot of explanations for that we can go into if you want to. But what's happening now is that we're just funneling this information around more effectively because of mass communication. It's really simple. It's because of the internet. Now we can talk about it.
Well, when you deal with people in grief, I mean, nobody wants to see someone die that they care about. Nobody. You know, regardless of what age. And we've all had tragedies in our lives where, you know, my dad died at 88. I still miss him, but it was a great run. I mean, to get to 88 and live the way he lived, that's pretty good. Yet my sister died at 56. I think that was way too young. So there are some moments, at least for me, Terry, where grief is handled in a different way. You know, missing your dad, but knowing he lived a great life and a fulfilled life at 88 is one thing. Missing your sister, knowing that her life was cut short, is a different kind of grief. Have you found that people react to grief in a different way?
Yeah, because it's a different kind of loss. I don't know if it's a different kind of grief, but yes, you're exactly right. And the only way to really reconcile that difference is to look at a life that was, as you say, cut short, mm-hmm. and expand your theological and metaphysical outlook so that you can understand that life can't be cut short. No one can die before their time.
Yeah.
And what I find with the people that I work with in the hospital and in the hospice is they, like most of us, live with a set of assumptions about how life is supposed to work. A child should not die before its parents. A person should not die before they've reached their potential. And other assumptions. Marriage should last forever. Things like that, right? And what happens when an unexpected loss occurs is it shakes us out of those assumptions. And we have two choices of what we can do. We can either cling to that assumption, saying, she shouldn't have died, it was too soon, it was before her time, this wasn't supposed to happen. Or we can let the assumptions go and replace them with new beliefs. And that kind of hits right at the heart of what I do and what I teach, is I help grieving people open up their minds to a view from space, to a bigger view of what existence means.
Are those who... Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay, go ahead.
Are those who are about to die, young or old, are they scared?
Some of them aren't. Children actually aren't. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, in the last 20 years of her career, worked exclusively with children. And the kids did things like draw pictures of rainbows and, you know, floating in the sky and all the kind of stuff that we know that children see in near-death experiences that Melvin Morse discovered in his research. And the children were very much at peace. The only thing that really shook them up was their parents' anxiety. And so children, for the most part, who are terminally ill absolutely do know that something is happening, and they're comfortable with it. Adults, not so much, because adults have had, you know, 30, 40, 50, 80 years of conditioning and programming to teach them to be afraid. And it also has to do with the way that you die and the kind of environment that you die in. If you are in hospice and you have good spiritual support, you're not going to be as afraid as if you're someone who's just fighting, and you're in the ICU, and you're in the oncology ward, constantly in and out of the emergency room, with doctors constantly fighting to keep you alive. There's a lot of fear with that. So we can die in different ways, and the ways that we choose can alleviate or exacerbate the fear.
How many people, or what percent of the people that you deal with, don't believe that there's life after death?
Very few. Almost everybody believes that there's life after
death. I like
death.
That. That's good.
Well, you know, I'm sure you've seen the studies that I think the Gallup poll and others have done that, you know, show that most people in the world believe that there's life after death, because most religions believe that, and most people subscribe to most religions. What's really interesting is when I'm working in the hospital and I'm talking to patients, they will confess things to me that they don't say to their family members. I'll be talking with them and they'll say, "Oh yeah, I've died three times. You know, I've been to the other side. I know there's a heaven. I saw my dead grandmother." They'll tell me this. And I hear it much more frequently than I ever thought that I would. So I think if you create a safe space for people to express those things without feeling judged, more people are going to come out and say that that's what they truly feel. But one way or another, I think the vast majority of people worldwide believe that there's some sort of life after death. Unfortunately, some of them think, you know, there's eternal punishment in hell and eternal reward in heaven, but at least that's an afterlife. They'll find out when they get there that it's not like that.
Tell me about your afterlife conference.
Well, the conference started in 2010. And when I was responding to, there is a grief group, a national grief group for grieving parents that has a huge conference every year. And I found out that they wouldn't let any presenters come and talk about after-death communication. They were very uncomfortable with that topic, and at the time there were a lot of us writing books and being out there teaching and talking about after-death communication, and this organization said, absolutely not, we will not have this at our conference. So I decided to start my own conference. It was that simple. And we're now in our sixth year. Can I say our website?
Of course.
Afterlifeconference.com. And we have had all the leading experts in this topic. Raymond Moody is on our board. He comes every year. Eben Alexander, Stuart Hameroff.
I was just with Eben in Denver taping some TV shows. Great guy.
Yeah, he's a very, very sweet guy, very lovely to work with. And so everybody, you know, I mean, the cream of the crop has, you know, comes to our conference, and we're very, very proud of it. And one thing we do that's a little different is not only do we examine the survival of consciousness after death, you know, through research and near-death experience stories, we also bring in the mystical piece. So we have a team of shamanic practitioners that teach how to work with a dying person, processes and rituals to help separate the soul from the body, grieving rituals to symbolically express our grief and our pain and move it through ourselves so that it's not stuck inside our bodies.
Hold on, Terry. We're at the bottom of the hour, but we're going to come right back and talk more about this incredible subject, after-death communication, life after death. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Terry Daniel with us as we talk about her work on the afterlife, Turning the Corner on Grief Street, How Trauma and Loss Can Transform Us, one of her books as well. Terry, when you deal with those who have lost someone or they're going to lose someone, how do you even start talking to them? God, that's got to be difficult. What do you say?
That's a great question. And it answers itself, because what you do is you don't start talking to them. You let them start talking.
They talk to you.
Yeah. And in chaplaincy training, that is the thing they emphasize the most. And it's the hardest thing for most of us to learn, is how to listen instead of talk.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with it all the time. So we are very, very heavily trained to, when we walk into a room to talk to a patient or a family, to leave our personal beliefs at the door, to not lead the conversation unless the conversation requests leadership, and to create a space where you just get the person talking. That is always the key, because they will talk and talk and talk when they feel that they're safe and that somebody is really seeing and hearing them. And once that starts happening, it becomes very easy to help them, because they're asking for help. So the delicate balance is to not try to help them, if that makes sense, and to not try to direct them unless they ask. So I'll give you an example.
Sure.
I saw a patient in the hospital the other day, a man in his 60s who had had back surgery. It was nothing really serious, but he had just come out of surgery. He was just coming off the drugs. He was in a lot of pain, and I walked in, and he said, "Oh, chaplain, I'm in so much pain. Is God punishing me?" And so my response was to say, well, my concern is why you would think that God is punishing you. Well, because I'm in so much pain, I'm in so much pain. I am not ethically allowed to say, no, God's not punishing you. God doesn't work that way. There isn't that kind of God.
Yeah,
punishment doesn't
exactly
exist. I'm not allowed to say any of that unless the man asks me directly. So it's a very tricky
really
thing.
How come you're not allowed to say that?
Well,
unless they ask you.
Well, because it would be the same as me walking into a room and preaching, you know, you better be saved to Jesus or you're going to go to hell, in terms of treating everybody equally, right? So we're not supposed to preach unless the person asks. So then he said, you know, oh, but I'm in so much pain. I'm in so much pain. And then he said to me, do you think that God punishes people?
That's
and
the question,
the
right?
Opening.
And there's
yes
the opening.
And then I could go right in and tell him. And then, you know, so we talked about that for a while, and he said, well, then why am I in so much pain? And I said, because they just cut your back open. It's really just
you're a human being, and you've just been sliced.
You've been sliced. It hurts, you know, and you've got a lot of stress and fear, and you're on all these drugs, and you'll be okay in a couple days.
I bet it
has nothing to do. Yeah.
It can't be easy to be a hospice worker. It can't be easy.
Well, you know, when you talk to people who work in hospice, everybody says that. And the hospice people will say, I love it. It isn't easy, but it's my passion. And, you know, I would rather be sitting with a dying person than pretty much anything else at all.
Really? Why?
Because because it's so spiritually pristine. It's so mystical. And because you can go with them, you can travel to where they are. And it is the most peaceful space. Now, I'm not talking about somebody who just got run over by a train. I'm talking about someone who is dying peacefully, actively dying. And what happens metaphysically is, and there are processes you can do, and we teach this process, you can do, well, what William Peters calls a shared death experience. And I've had this experience many times, where if you're sitting with a dying person and you can empty yourself emotionally and be completely present with them and synchronize your breathing with their breathing and go into a meditative space, you can travel with them. You can experience what they're experiencing. Not 100%, but you can go into that zone of peace and divine love that they are feeling when they are between worlds. Because when they're dying, they're moving back and forth between this dimension and the other one and all the other ones. And so when you're going into a room and you're visiting your mother on her deathbed and she looks like she's unconscious, she appears to be unconscious in this dimension, but she's hyper super conscious on the other side. And one of the things that my son said to me that's in my book, A Swan in Heaven, is when you're watching someone dying and their breaths are becoming erratic,
very labored, fading,
and either labored or there's a lot of different things that happen with the breath. What's happening is with every struggling breath on earth, it becomes light in heaven. That's what my son said. Breath on earth.
I've got to ask you, because you've been at the bedside of people who have died, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And I've got to ask you this out of curiosity. When someone dies, what is it at that moment that they've finally died from? And I mean, we've heard of heart attacks or they had a tumor or this, but I mean, in the dying moment, what is it that stops everything? Is it just they stop breathing? Do they?
Well, I'm not a doctor, so I probably can't answer that in a technically correct way. And maybe there's a doctor who would like to call in and explain that better than I can. But my understanding is there's only two ways to die. Cardiac and respiratory. Either your heart stops or your breathing stops. But the breathing and the heart work together. So if you're breathing, in other words, if you stop breathing and they put you on a respirator, that will keep your heart going.
Because I would guess if you stop breathing, do you like black out instantly without pain? I mean, I can't think of anything worse than suffocating to death. I mean, hold your breath until you like think you're going to black out. Is that how dying is? That's not a way I want to go.
It depends how you die. Now, if we go back to hospice, what hospice does is it gives you drugs to ease that suffocating feeling. But yes, that is what happens when you stop breathing. But it doesn't last long because you black out very quickly. In hospice, there are certain drug cocktails that they give you. And, you know, I've seen people dying of, really bad respiratory conditions, congestive heart failure, things like that, where the breathing is so labored.
Yeah.
It's worse to live with that kind of breathing.
I mean, the singer-comedian Dean Martin died that way. He had lung cancer and respiratory issues and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen people in complete panic because they couldn't get a breath.
Ugh.
But the drugs calm that down. That's what the drugs are for. You know, people think you go to hospice and they give you morphine and tell you to go to the light. It's not really.
Well, what if you're not at hospice? What if you're just at home and that happens to you?
Well, then that's the thing. You know, that I mean, if you've ever seen someone have a heart attack, which you've probably seen in movies and TV, you know, it's kind of dramatized, but it is like that. You know, it is like that. You will lose your breath. You will struggle to breathe. You will get panicky. And then you'll black out. So it all depends. There's many, many ways to die.
I mean, like the person who dies in a car crash. It's so fast and it's instant. But is there any pain at all, even for a split second? Or it's just black all of a sudden. Just that car hits you and you're gone.
I don't know. I really don't know the answer to that question. But I know from what I've heard from mediums and people who are talking to people who've died that way, people on the other side, they will tell you that there was no pain. Also, what happens, as I've been taught from my spirit guides and helpers on the other side, is that you tend to leave your body actually before that happens, so that you're not necessarily conscious of that panic moment of that.
Now, that's an interesting twist. That's the way to go.
Well, that's what, you know, they say. And when I say they, what I mean is the dead people, we call them dead people, you know, who communicate through our mediums at the conference. And that's what they say. You know, I was out of my body the second that car hit me.
A lot of people who report dying and they've come back say that they don't want to come back.
Oh, yeah.
that those on the other side kind of want to force them back. Hey, no, it's not time. You got to get back. They don't want to come back. They're peaceful.
Well, I don't think those on the other side will ever force them back, but they will tell you that you have a choice. They will say, you know, you can stay here or you can go back. And people will say, oh, I want to stay here. I want to stay here. But what will happen is you'll have kind of like a life review in a near-death experience,
yeah.
And you'll see the things on Earth that you want to come back to. The choice is ultimately your own because you have free will. So you can't be forced to go back.
Terry, with what you're learning, are you learning and changing all the time? I mean, are you picking up new things about after death, what it is, what's happening?
Yes, absolutely, all the time. And what's changing mostly for me is how I perceive this whole world of paranormal study and mediumship and the whole woo-woo world. What I'm seeing is that there is now a medium and a shaman and a death doula on every corner, and it's become a trend. There's an aspect of this work that I guess happens in every part of the culture where it's like it's the new thing, it's the new cool thing to do, to work in the death field. So I see that a lot, and it pushes me away from this work a little bit. It makes me kind of not want to associate it with it too much because I see that there's a lot of, I don't know how to really put this, but people not taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
People going out there and acting as if they're doing the work, but they're not really doing the work. They're not really studying. Okay, here's what I mean by that. I have learned that in order to work with death, the afterlife, mediumship, or grief, you cannot eliminate the need to learn about theology and psychology and some of these other things. And I am really bothered by people who call themselves grief guides or spiritual teachers who work with death who haven't really studied it and don't necessarily have practical experience. So that's what changes for me a little bit is I kind of pull away from being part of all that.
How come the ancients seem to have known more about life after death and what to expect when you die than we do today?
That's a very good question. I think because they lived so close to nature, that when you live in a nature-based life, it's really hard to take spirituality out of the picture. When you're living with the cycles of the seasons and the plant life and the planetary movements, spirituality is right in your face. But the more we moved away from that, now we live in houses and we're not attuned to these things, we've lost our sense of connection with the natural cycles, with nature, which is spirit. And so we don't have the rituals anymore. So when we lost the ritual of celebrating the coming of spring with, you know, planting rituals and reproductive rituals, or acknowledging winter with winter rituals, which became our Christmas holiday rituals, when we stopped doing that, when all that stuff got superimposed over by religious and biblical narratives, that's where we lost it.
Yeah, and we lost it in a big way.
Connected with that, yeah.
Can we get it back? Generally, can we get it back?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know how easy it is to get it back? Just go outside and stand barefoot on the grass, and you're there. You know, I mean, it's real.
Or look at the stars at night, right?
Yeah, go outside of your house and look at the stars. But what I really love is ritual, and teaching ritual is a really big part of what I do. And I do a big winter solstice ritual. I do spring rituals. Rituals give form to the formless. So you take an event somewhere in the universe, any event, spring coming, or somebody dying, or somebody being born, or a butterfly landing on a flower, any event in the universe. And if you make a ritual that symbolizes that event and make it part of your life, you have now reconnected with the natural cycle of everything in the universe. That's how we bring it back, by just bringing ritual and nature back into our world.
If you could change one thing about people's attitude toward life after death, what would that be? Whether it be an insider or the medical profession or whatever, what would you change?
Well, two things. The medical profession, I would make sure that all medical students are educated in end-of-life care and understanding what hospice care really is, because most doctors do not understand it, and it's really tragic what happens when doctors will not refer a patient to hospice because they don't understand what hospice really does. That would be the first thing. And the second thing is I would eliminate the concept of hell completely from every thought system on the planet.
A lot of people believe in hell. A lot of people don't. Where does Terry Daniel fit in?
Well, you know, this is semantics. Hell, and you've read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, so you know that what happens to the soul in that first 40 days of Bardo is that it goes through different experiences. And we know this from near-death experience reports, too, that we have a life review. And some people have reported having a scary experience in their life review. And the ancients reported this too. Everything we know about the afterlife, not everything, most of it that's recorded in antiquity, comes from people who have had near-death experiences, who came back and talked about it to the villagers. And it gets recorded into archives. Anyway, so what happens in a life review is you may have hellish experiences, because what you're looking at is your own projections. You're looking at the stuff that you've accumulated in your incarnation, in all your incarnations, or in Buddhism, they would say, you know, the karma that you're burning off. And so when you leave the body, you get this little panorama of this stuff. You feel the feelings of pain that you've experienced before, pain that you've caused for other people. You have to look at your stuff, and that's not fun. And that is the experience that I think came to be known as hell. And when people have come back in a near-death experience, we have to remember that they didn't go all the way to the other side. They just set their foot inside the doorway, and then they came back. So all they know is what happens in that entryway, in that, you know, initial entry phase. The only way we know what happens when you're fully dead, fully on the other side, is what we hear from mediums.
By the way, your conference this year is going to be in my hometown of St. Louis.
Oh.
Did you know
that? That's lovely.
I don't know where I am that weekend, May 12th
to
the 15th.
Come by and see us. That would be fantastic.
That's great. And say hi to Raymond Moody for me as well. He's a great guy. Great guy.
Say hi to Raymond Moody what?
Say hi to him for me.
Oh, well, actually, this is the first year Raymond's not actually going to be
there. Oh, he's not going to be there this year.
No, he's going to be there on Skype this year.
Well, that's good. Anyways, Terry, we're going to come back and talk more, but we're going to take phone calls from people who are interested in this for a number of reasons, including the grief portion. We'll be back.